From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins, in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Is Nigeria ready to dump President Goodluck Jonathan in tomorrow's election in Africa's most populous country? We'll ask NPR's Afabia Quist-Arkton, who's in the capital, Abuja.
But first, to New York City, where at least two people are unaccounted for and 25 are injured after yesterday's explosion in East Village. The explosion caused three buildings to collapse, and it extensively damaged a fourth building. Firefighters have been working through the night and into today to put out the last pockets of fire. Mayor Bill de Blasio said that preliminary evidence points to a gas explosion. Stephen Nesson is covering this story for WNYC. He is with us from the East Village. Stephen, what are you hearing about what may have actually caused the explosion? What's the latest?
Well, the latest preliminary information is that Con Edison and a private contractor were at the scene an hour before the explosion. Apparently, they were installing a new gas main. It didn't pass the inspection. Workers left, and an hour later, there was an explosion. It's unclear if the events are connected, but many are pointing to the fact that Con Edison was doing work at the site just prior to the explosion.
So right now, we know that investigators are, of course, on the scene. There may not be a lot of information revealed right away. It's an extensive explosion. Can you tell us what it looks like? Because you're very close to it right now, and I know that last night you saw the more immediate results. What are you seeing now?
Last night there were two buildings standing. Now they're just debris and rubble. Firefighters had to bring them down last night. They were smoldering and in flames. They sprayed it all night, and they're continuing to spray. The remains are still smoldering. There's smoke coming off the site. There's a little bit of an acrid metallic smell in the air here. They're continuing to spray down the building. There are two people that are still missing. There could be more. As the day goes on, we'll find out if there are more people unaccounted for that may have been in the building at the time.
We know that New York has one of the oldest gas main systems in the entire country. And one of your colleagues at WNYC reported last year after the Harlem explosion, the one that destroyed two tenement buildings, killed eight people. The report said that New York also has the leakiest gas pipes in the nation. Has the sequence of events put New Yorkers on edge?
Absolutely. Here in the East Village, this is a historic district. The building that exploded is over 100 years old. The buildings next to it are also more than 100 years old. And these buildings, they keep getting built on top of. People are always adding layers to these buildings. And it's not sitting on sturdy bedrock in the East Village anyways. Different parts of the city are, of course. And it's been heavily developed in this area as well as throughout the island. So there's a lot of concern about the quality of the pipes. And this time of year is when weather's fluctuating. There's a lot of potholes, of course, and pipes also are ruptured at this time of year because of the change in temperature from winter to spring.
So to what extent, I wonder, are people talking about and investigators talking about these two explosions, Harlem last year and now this one just yesterday, as being part of a larger infrastructure safety problem in New York City? Or do they think it's just too early to tell?
Well, it's definitely too early to tell. But if you talk to infrastructure buffs, they're going to tell you the whole city needs to be redone. Different pipes have been laid at different times. They're not always well connected. In fact, the Harlem explosion that you mentioned, a report came out just last week, and that explosion occurred over a year ago. So these things are somewhat hard to unravel exactly what went wrong and what can we do going forward to prevent future explosions like this.
Thank you, Stephen. Speaking to us from the scene of yesterday's blast in New York City, Stephen Nesson of WNYC. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, voters in Nigeria will head to the polls tomorrow to decide if President Goodluck Jonathan will stay in office. Presidential and parliamentary elections were scheduled for mid-February, but were delayed in part because of the insecurity in the Northeast and fears that the military was needed for a regional offensive against Boko Haram. Today, the military claimed it had destroyed Boko Haram's headquarters and retaken the northeastern city occupied by the Islamist extremists since last summer. NPR's Afabia Quist-Arkton is in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, with more. Hi, Afabia.
Greetings.
And can you tell us about the candidates? President Goodluck Jonathan is the incumbent. Who are the competitors and what are they campaigning on?
There are plenty of them, but let me just home in on the main opposition challenger, a former military leader here in Nigeria, ex-General Muhammadu Buhari. He is trying for the third time to become Nigeria's president. As I say, he was in charge of this country during the military era, and many Nigerians see him as having been tough on security and also tough on corruption. And in a country where patronage, I mean, Nigeria is Africa's leading oil exporter. It's the top economy. It is literally the powerhouse of the continent. So there is plenty of money here. Candidate Buhari says he will stop corruption to make sure that the money trickles down to all Nigerians and is used for the benefit of the country.
And does he have a good chance of winning, or does Jonathan look like he's on top?
We're being told by those in the know that this is the most competitive presidential vote ever in Nigeria's history. And of course, the stakes are high, but here they are super high for whoever wins and the team that surrounds him. There is just one woman candidate, but she doesn't look as if she stands much of a chance.
Now, as we said, just a day ahead of the elections, the military is claiming to have destroyed Boko Haram's headquarters. Can you tell us more about that?
Gwoza was captured and occupied by Boko Haram. It must have been in about July, August last year. We now have about a million plus people who have been displaced and driven from their homes. Now, the timing seems rather convenient, coming on the eve of elections where President Goodluck Jonathan is seeking re-election. But this is what the army is telling us, that they have destroyed the headquarters, that they have captured what was the administrative center for Boko Haram. What was not mentioned, however, is the Sambisa Forest, which is in the same general local government area in Borno State. Now, that is where these schoolgirls were abducted almost a year ago, 15th of April last year. And that was apparently where they were initially taken to by Boko Haram fighters who kidnapped them in the dead of night. The military did not mention that, although it said that it had killed some militants and had taken many others captive.
And in fact, there are reports also that the land and sea borders are closed in advance of the election. And with those kidnappings you're talking about in the Northeast, what kind of security concerns are there for tomorrow's elections?
Yep. Closing the borders is par for the course. And there is enormous concern about security. One, because of the problems in the Northeast with the insurgency, but more generally because Nigeria, unfortunately, the giant as it is of West Africa, always seems to have election-related violence, either before, during, or after. And there have been calls from President Goodluck Jonathan, the main opposition contender, Muhammadu Buhari, President Obama, regional leaders, global leaders, that these elections must be free, fair, transparent, and devoid of violence, fear, and intimidation. Everybody is looking to Nigeria. Nigeria is Africa's number one country, apart from being its most populous. So everyone is saying, Nigeria, lead by example. If you come out of this with a successful election, your country is enhanced, the region is enhanced, and Africa is enhanced. And anyone who is seen to encourage violence or instigate violence, the International Criminal Court is waiting for you and has warned that anyone who is seen to have encouraged violence could find themselves in The Hague.
But Afebia, do Nigerians believe that either of these candidates would actually be able to stop Boko Haram from doing the kinds of things that it has been doing, these atrocities in Nigeria?
Yesterday, I put that very question to Muhammadu Buhari, the main opposition candidate, and he said, yes, I am known to be tough on security. If I am elected, one of the first things I'll do is gather together all the leaders of the region. And neighboring countries have sent troops to Nigeria to try to end the Boko Haram insurgency. He says that would be his priority, but President Goodluck Jonathan says, look, look what we're doing in the last 6 weeks. Look at how we've been able to push back Boko Haram and recapture so much territory. But Nigerians are asking, well, they've been terrorizing the Northeast for the past 6 years. So why is it just before elections that in 6 weeks you have been able to at least contain the insurgency in part? Was it a political move or was it a genuine move? And where are these missing 200 plus schoolgirls? We are waiting for you to bring them back home safely to their families.
NPR's Afabia Quist-Arkton in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, where there will be an election all across the country. Tomorrow we'll be watching. Afabia, thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Jeremy.
Okay, maybe this is Fear and Now. Don't be scared. That is sound from an old horror film. And the reason we're playing it is because there's a project underway at Yale University to collect films just like that one, horror films that were released on VHS tapes back in the late 70s and early 80s, films with titles like Toxic Zombies, Maniac, Buried Alive. The Yale archive so far includes about 2,700 tapes. And joining us from New Haven to talk about it are the people behind it, Aaron Pratt, a PhD student, and David Gary, Yale's Kaplanoff Librarian for American History. Guys, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Aaron, I want to start with you. This was your idea. Why did you want to create a VHS archive?
I invited Dave to my weekly movie night a while back that I've been doing for the last couple of years here in New Haven. And we got to talking about why it is that academic libraries aren't collecting this kind of material. And Dave, who is in a position to collect material, we got to talking about how we could actually make this possible. And through his efforts, we've been able to make it happen.
But is it about what's on the VHS tapes or is it about the VHS tapes themselves?
Well, it's a combination of the two, I think. On the one hand, you know, VHS was a technology that made it possible for a lot of movies to get made that wouldn't have been made otherwise. But also, VHS was, of course, the way that many of the movies that we now think of as classics of horror or classics of any other genre were not first made possible, but the ways in which they circulated and were made popular among home video audiences.
When you're talking about early VHS from 1978 to 1985, we're talking about movies costing $80 to $90 when those VHS tapes first came out. So it was very difficult for average people to just go out in the street and buy VHS. So it created this whole video store culture, and there was a huge demand for this. This is the first time that you could actually watch movies in the home. So this drove all sorts of distributors and producers to reach deep into their vaults and pull out old titles. It allowed the cheap technology of camcorders allowed people to shoot movies on video. And it allowed there was a large space because of this huge demand, this voracious demand for video at this time.
And Aaron, why did you decide to focus on horror movies?
Well, a couple of reasons. I mean, one of the kinds of films that have traditionally had difficult accessing traditional exhibition venues like the movie theaters are genre movies, right? On the one hand, they were cheap to make, and so they could often fill a theater or at least fill the sort of gap spaces in a theatrical exhibition run. But horror was one of the genres, along with action and, of course, something like pornography, were some of the first types of movies to really take the advantage of the affordances of VHS, right? If you could make a movie without ever having to plan to do a theatrical distribution, which would involve doing, you know, printing large numbers of 35 millimeter prints, having a marketing campaign that would target the radio or the TV. Without all of that, it would be much easier to get a movie into the hands of the consumer. And it seems as though horror movies and action movies were some of the first to really take that up. And so for the purpose of this collection, where it's, you know, it would be impossible to collect all of VHS, as anybody who ever went into a video store knows.
Yeah.
Everything was released on VHS. And horror, both because of its sort of specific relationship to VHS, but also the practical difficulty of collecting everything, we decided to narrow it down to horror.
Well, let's listen to one of the films that you have in your collection. This is called Class of 1984.
Surveillance is the name of the game around here, Mr. Norris. You wouldn't believe the things they do to this building whenever we aren't watching. Paint on the walls. They steal anything that isn't bolted down. Never leave your classroom unlocked, Mr. Norris, not even for a minute.
Yes, sir.
There, come here. Two of them smoking marijuana. Security?
Yes.
Two dope smokers and one West.
On my way.
So, Aaron, what was it about this one that was necessary for the collection?
Well, it's a movie that, I mean, it had a theatrical release, a small theatrical release. But it has attained a cult status now as this, you know, sort of Reagan-era document of delinquent culture and, you know, the sort of the drug culture, the sort of youth gone wild culture that was really driving a lot of the kind of 80s anxieties. And of course, like I said, it had a theatrical release, but it was only really once Vestron Video, one of these major VHS distributors, put it out in 1984, 85, that it was able to achieve the cult status because it became a video store staple that, you know, a teenage boy could rent and bring to his sleepover in the evening. And it's through that VHS context that it really was able to achieve a cult status. It wouldn't have been able to have that kind of longevity without the distribution that VHS made possible.
David Gary, how difficult was it to convince the library administration to take on this VHS collection?
Not terribly difficult. So when I do collecting, I have to make sure that I can prove that there's going to be an interest in this material, that there's an academic audience for it. But then I had to make sure that I convinced the preservation people that, you know, this is coming. We're going to work on making sure we get the resources to get this preserved. And then the other problem, which I'm sure you can imagine, is access, which would be getting a number of VCRs and stations put together. So what we're doing with this collection is making it archival in nature. So it's going to be a special collections archive. So all of this material is going to be stored in an offsite storage area called the Library Shelving Facility, which has proper environmental controls, and it will be brought in for researchers in an archival situation.
Well, how do you make the case, though, that it is academically important?
Oh, hugely important. So, you know, so Aaron and I are both historians of the book. That's how we met originally. So we care about the book as a physical object through time. And we can easily make the argument that VHS is just another extension of that. So what we really care about with this collection is looking at VHS as a material object, as a piece of material culture. So there are lots of things that are sort of connected to it that I think a lot of people can use. So when you have a book, you talk about the table of contents, the acknowledgement page, the preface. This sort of leads you into the text and helps you interpret it and understand it. The same sort of thing is going on here with VHS. You have trailers and previews, you have labels, you have blurbs, and you have this really excellent box art. All of these things sort of help you think about the movie, interpret the movie, and get into the movie. And it helps you really understand the reception of the movie. So there's all sorts of interest in just the material aspect of this format, not just the content of the movies. But I can imagine all sorts of people using this collection. So, you know, I had a question this semester, a student writing about the history of fires in the Bronx in the 1970s, who wanted to see film representation of the Bronx as a wasteland in the 1970s and the 1980s. He could easily go to this collection and pull out movies and take a look at various films. I've had people contact me since this story came out. There's an art photographer who uses horror film themes throughout his art who wants to come and take a look at the boxes. You know, right now, film studies, I think in general, you could say that they're really interested in looking at the original 35mm film, but we're starting to see a whole batch of scholarship that's coming out now that's focusing on video and the problems of video and the sort of everyday nature of video. And I think that scholarship is only going to be growing into the future.
But there are going to be some people who are listening to this, and I'll go back to you, Aaron, who say, wow, I can't believe that people at Yale, of all places, are focusing on something like this. It seems frivolous to some people.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons I came to Yale as a PhD student is because of the way that its library has been able to collect and preserve the cultural heritage of, you know, many cultures. I happen to study Shakespeare in the 16th and 17th centuries primarily. And, you know, Yale has shown a strong commitment to preserving that kind of material. And it's a place like Yale, I think, that's especially in a position to really be able to collect this kind of stuff and to really be able to blaze the trails, as it were.
But are you comparing class of 1984 to Shakespeare?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of debate about, you know, to what exactly was the role of early modern theater, you know, for example. And so the question is, you know, what do we do with popular entertainment? And one of the challenges for the work that I do when I look into the 16th and 17th centuries is so much of that material has been lost because, you know, in some cases, people didn't preserve it in the time. And right now, as we're sitting sort of just on the other side of VHS's sort of initial lifespan, right? I mean, the last commercial VHS tapes sort of released by the studios were coming out 2003, 2004. And so we're in a position right now where there's this kind of gap where nobody's interested in it yet, but we're right on the edge of it being potentially thrown away. There's a group out of Canada that's been working on thinking about how to recycle, you know, the unused VHS tapes. And I think it's a place, we're at a time right now where Yale could really come in and is coming in and trying to preserve this aspect of a sort of popular, as it were, sort of entertainment culture.
And at this point in 2015, is the quality still pretty good of that tape, or has it already deteriorated in some cases?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I would say first off is many, many of these tapes are in very, very good condition. I mean, I collect VHS myself, and I have tapes from, you know, 1978, 1979, the very early 80s that play as well as they did in 1980. Of course, you know, most of these movies, as I think Dave mentioned earlier, weren't really sold directly to consumers. And so they spent a lot of their life as in heavy retail context. And even those tapes are in pretty good condition.
I remember seeing, I'm sure on VHS, Poltergeist. And I must have been like 8 years old. It scared the hell out of me. But
well, and that's the thing, you know, because it's a lot of those times, you know, kids would be able to watch things that their parents would have never taken them to the theater to see.
Right.
But either because they were on cable or there was a tape kicking around the house, so many young lives were sort of maybe damaged or enriched, depending on how you want to see it, based on the kind of things that they were able to see in the home.
That's Aaron Pratt, a PhD student at Yale University, and David Gary, the Kaplanoff Librarian for American History there, talking with us about their new VHS archive. We've got more information. Maybe you've got some tapes to send them. Go to hearandnow.org. Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for you.
Thank you.
If you're one of those who waits until the last minute to file, this year is not a good year to do that. Budget cuts at the IRS are creating roadblocks for many people. Sarah Lerner from Here and Now contributor KUOW reports from Seattle.
Last December, we got the warning straight from the IRS commissioner. He said cuts mandated by Congress have hit the IRS 5 years in a row, and this year is going to be tough. Tough for people like 78-year-old Susan Dean in Tacoma, Washington. Dean has never owned a cell phone, does not have a computer.
Oh, there's your cat. Is that your cat?
That's one of them, yeah.
Dean has her tax prep routine down. In January, she began like she always does, by setting up her special card table for tax documents. Next.
Just had to go pick up the new form, which I've been doing, really, for 30-some years.
So she went to the library, like usual.
I was kind of shocked to see this sign on the post saying, due to cuts in federal funding, the IRS will not be sending out paper and the instruction booklet and all of the forms this year.
The booklet is key. Dean could have the library staff help her print the forms, but not a 50-page instruction booklet. The sign did direct her to an 800 number, though.
Seeing that, I hurried home and tried to call the number.
The IRS commissioner also warned about that. Long wait times when trying to call. Eventually, Dean did manage to order her forms through a special 800 number set up just for that.
When your option is to try to do it online or try to download the forms or try to request it, that is a huge barrier.
Yuri Kim manages a free tax prep program for United Way.
For the people who are actually looking for these forms, it becomes a big deal.
Kim believes the IRS cuts hurt the low-income and elderly population the most. The forms are actually only a tiny part of the problem. I met Kim at the Seattle Public Library, one of the locations where his volunteers prepare taxes.
Okay, let's start with your Social Security card and your ID. Thank you.
Pairs of volunteers and clients are scattered at tables along a closed-off section of the library. They're all speaking quietly while the tax preparers enter data on laptops. The IRS helps fund programs like these. But Kim says his job is more difficult this year.
They're basically asking us to do a lot more with the same number of dollars.
That's because the IRS used to offer free tax prep for poor taxpayers, too, just like United Way, but no longer.
To be frank, I understand that the IRS has to make cuts, but it does put this population in a tougher situation than they probably have been in the past.
After 6 weeks, the forms still hadn't arrived to Susan Dean's house in Tacoma.
Raindrop! Here, kitty!
Where she hangs out with tea and her two cats.
Okay, she lost her chance.
But no matter, Dean solved her problem. Remember, she doesn't have a computer. She doesn't go online to look for information, but she did sleep on it.
Thinking about it overnight and all, I remembered that once I'd had an IRS question and had gone to this building on Pacific Avenue. So I thought, maybe that'll be there and maybe I can go there.
It was true. There is an IRS Taxpayer Assistance Center in downtown Tacoma. And they had the forms. Dean filled it out and filed her taxes, and now she's fine. Except she worries about everyone else.
I want people to know, guess what? The way it's always been isn't going to be that way this year.
The forms are no longer widely distributed. And, along with many other delays, here's another one. The IRS says refunds will come back slower this year. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Lerner in Seattle.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid announced today that he is not seeking re-election to the Senate in 2016. Reid is 75 and suffered injuries exercising shortly after Democrats lost control of the Senate. He made his announcement in a video to supporters.
This accident has caused us, for the first time, to have a little downtime. I have had time to ponder and to think. We've got to be more concerned about the country, the Senate, the state of Nevada, than us. And as a result of that,
Reid's departure sets up a leadership scramble. And joining us to talk about that and other political news is Bloomberg's White House and politics correspondent, Margaret Tolove. Margaret, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And let's talk about this. How significant is this that Harry Reid has decided not to seek re-election?
I mean, it is on the one hand really stunning political news in Washington. On the other hand, if you've been in the Senate in the last couple of months, not really a surprise at all. This accident has taken a lot out of him, and it's also not very much fun to govern in the minority, although it's not been very much fun to govern for a while there anyway.
Yeah.
The combination of these things and Reid's age, he says this is something that he was thinking about anyway. I think, you know, when you're a politician in his position, you sort of put all the pieces together and say, you know what, I just don't want to do this anymore.
And the people that many thought would replace him included possibly Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, although now Reid has gotten behind New York Senator Chuck Schumer.
Chuck Schumer. The field has cleared pretty quickly. The Democrats seem to be trying to get a strategy in place. And, you know, the interesting thing to watch in terms of Democratic politics is going to be how Schumer, who has these sort of New York and Wall Street connections, connections to Clinton and so forth, will be viewed by kind of the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders wing of the party. And there's some effort by Reid to try to sort of preemptively control this by he's slid these people into leadership positions. Warren has a title, you know, now inside the caucus. And a big part of that effort is to try to say there's room kind of, you know, for both in the party.
Hmm. Now, some interesting news on the House side of the Capitol. A rare bipartisan bill passed in the House with the support of both Republicans and Democrats, both House Speaker John Boehner and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Tell us about that bill. What is it? What's so great about it that it's the first thing that they all can get behind?
Right. And when you come to realize that it's about health care, it's doubly shocking when you look at the fight in Obamacare, right? So this is the so-called doc fix, which is like this nerdy insider thing, unless you're over 65 and care about, you know, your Medicare coverage. But this idea that the reimbursement rates are stretched and are going to get cut, and the doctors are saying, look, you're cutting our payments, and we're not going to be able to continue providing care for the elderly at this rate. And so you did have a real coming together of Republicans and Democrats. You don't see that very often anymore at all on the Hill. But it happened for a couple reasons. One is the agreement by Republicans to include some children's health insurance coverage in there and to make wealthier recipients of care bear a little bit more of the brunt of the cost. Also is really fundamentally the concern about doctors getting paid. So this is something that Republicans have pressed for a long time. Democrats needed some concessions to make it happen.
So lots to keep an eye on in Washington. We'll see what happens with that bill in the Senate.
That's
but
right.
We really asked you here, Margaret, to help us with our weekly look at the race for the White House in 2016. And for that, we are also joined by NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne. Hi, Don.
Hey, hi to both of you.
Hi, Don.
And this
hi.
Was the week of Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, who became the first candidate to really get into the race, announced he's running for president. He did that in a speech at Liberty University in Virginia. Here he is.
Roughly half of born-again Christians aren't voting. They're staying home. Imagine instead millions of people of faith all across America coming out to the polls and voting our values.
So, Don, he is going after the base of the Republican Party. How was his first week?
You heard his target audience right there. He feels like there is a lane for him to build a coalition of Tea Party activists. He's got the Tea Party. He's been a favorite of theirs since day one, and he's really championed their cause. But he also wants to bring in that really significant part of the GOP primary and especially Iowa caucus audience, which is evangelical Christians. But here's what's interesting. I mean, the day went off off pretty much without a hitch for him. It was at the convocation at Liberty University.
So everyone had to be there.
They had to be there. It wasn't a big rally. They're required to go, which isn't to say that they weren't happy to see him and happy to hear from him. But there were also a lot of Rand Paul T-shirts in the crowd. And I found Chris Christie supporters and people who told me they think they need maybe something and someone a little more moderate than Ted Cruz if they're going to beat Hillary Clinton. But again, it was a very friendly crowd, but in part because there was action happening in the Senate that he had to be part of, there wasn't the big rollout tour where he immediately went to New Hampshire.
But
and then
the big
to
question,
Iowa.
Though, is does he really get helped by being first? And on CBS this week, David Letterman actually poked fun at that idea of early announcers. Let's listen.
Republican Senator Ted Cruz is the first official candidate for the 2016 presidential election. And as history has shown, the first declared candidate always goes on to win the election. Except in 2012, 2008, 2004, 2000, 1996, 1992, 1988.
So Margaret, does he benefit from being first at all?
Well, the question is that what it's really about? Is he doing this because he thinks he can win the nomination? And there's still a big question mark attached to that. I mean, he does know that his best window, if he wants to kind of triangulate, pick up the low-hanging fruit on Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee supporters who think those guys aren't going anywhere, if he really wants to compete against Rand Paul for that space in the party, going first was his best shot. It's not to say that, going first will help him win, but to say that if he didn't go first, he might have worse of a chance of winning.
And he did get a couple of days of publicity out of it.
That's
never a bad thing.
Okay, on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton began the week with a speech in which she joked about how she wanted a clean slate with the press.
But I am all about new beginnings. A new grandchild, another new hairstyle, a new email account. Why not a new relationship with the press?
Don, how can someone who's had a multi-decade relationship with the press really ask for a clean slate with a straight face? I guess she had a smirk on her face there.
Yes, again, it was done firmly with tongue in cheek, and I think she immediately afterward told people to look under their seats, Oprah style, and there they would find the non-disclosure agreement that they should sign. Listen, there will be no new beginning with the press. There probably are ways that she can improve her relationship with the press. They were very kind of tense and at times contentious during her last presidential campaign. But if you talk to people who covered her at the State Department, they found plenty of time to have off-the-record conversations with her and time on the plane and time when she would be more relaxed. But in the heat of this campaign, it's going to be a big challenge for her to show anybody, a significantly different Hillary Clinton. And when push comes to shove, when the tough stories start being written, you can bet that they'll push hard, very hard back.
Well, Margaret, we haven't heard anything from Hillary Clinton on the issue of Israel yet, which is interesting.
She, so far in this months-long lead-up to will she, won't she, when everyone knows she will, but she hasn't said she will yet, there's been a real deliberate effort by her to remain cautious. She was invited to this J Street group that Dennis McDonough spoke at the beginning of the week and, politely, even she was in D.C. or on her way down, politely declined that invitation. She doesn't want to put herself in a box that she can't get out of and sees no upside in making statements that are going to be hung around her neck later when she hasn't even announced her run yet. The problem is that at some point, this thing has to start. And there are early reports now that she wants to do, once she does announce the start of this campaign, that she wants to do a reintroducing Hillary to America campaign. Begs the same question as the question with the press. After, two or three decades in American life, doesn't America already know her?
Don, we just have 30 seconds left or so, but let me ask you this. Who's in better position right now on the Republican side, Jeb Bush or Scott Walker?
Oh, I think it's just way too early to say. We know that Jeb Bush has a lot of money. Again, he hasn't announced yet. He's trying to run a general election campaign in the primaries. Scott Walker has had some stumbles. But again, people are still giving him a very close look. And that's probably exactly where he had hoped to be.
And they're both now in a box on immigration policy. So that's just good fun.
All right. Lots more to talk about as we continue our weekly series on 2016. Margaret Tolliff, White House and politics correspondent for Bloomberg News, and Don Gagne, national political correspondent for NPR. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
All right, it's a pleasure.
I think we only have, what, a year and a little bit to go? This is Here and Now.
This week, in collaboration with member station WNYC, NPR is exploring progress in fighting cancer. One frequent question is whether we're winning the war on cancer that President Nixon declared back in 1971. Joining us to talk about that is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Now, Richard, I know this is a complicated question, but are we winning the war on cancer?
Well, Lisa, not surprisingly, there are a number of ways to get at that question. And I guess I'll start with the glass half empty view first and then get to the more optimistic view a little bit later. So first of all, if you look at the sheer number of Americans who die from cancer each year, that continues to grow year by year. It's now more than 500,000 people a year, and cancer makes up almost a quarter of all the deaths in this country. That also, of course, means that the cost of cancer is rising, and the National Institutes of Health estimates that the cost of cancer treatment will grow by something like 39% in this decade alone. And I might add that that estimate assumes very modest increases in the cost of care, and that's maybe pretty optimistic.
Yeah, that sounds fairly grim, and it sounds like the answer would basically be no, that we're losing the war on cancer.
Yeah, and one person who makes that assertion, with some caveats, is a man named Clifton Leaf, who's an editor at Fortune magazine. And he wrote a book on the topic called The Truth in Small Doses. Interestingly, he's a cancer survivor himself of many years, so he actually provides his own bit of a counterexample. But Leaf is not completely pessimistic. He does see that there has been incremental progress in treating many types of cancer. But he says, overall, there's really not enough effort being put into preventing cancer in the first place. And that's where we could really be making a huge difference, even if cancer researchers aren't really able to produce these amazing cures that we all hoped for back in 1971.
Right. But in truth, more people are also living with cancer, even if the number of people dying from it is growing. So what's the glass half full side?
Right. So there are 14 million Americans right now who are alive with cancer. So you're right. There are many people who are living with cancer. And that said, nobody's claiming that the situation is completely out of hand. But there's plenty of evidence that things are moving in the right direction. For example, while the number of cancer deaths has increased by 4% during the previous decade, the number of Americans has increased by 10%. So in proportion to the population, you can see that cancer is actually on the decline. And the change is even more dramatic than those numbers suggest. Yes, because, you know, cancer is mostly a disease of older people, and the proportion of people in our population who are older has been growing and growing and growing. So if you look at it from an individual's risk of dying from cancer, that number is actually falling gradually.
Yeah. Why is it falling? Is that a result of the money that this country and perhaps other countries have invested in the fight against cancer?
Yes. Well, several things are at play. And first of all, smoking is overwhelmingly the largest cause of cancer. But millions of people have quit smoking. And the result of that is we're seeing a strong decline in lung cancer and related diseases as a result. So prevention is playing a really important role there. Other forms of prevention make a big difference, too, like colonoscopies. You know, most people at the age of 50 are told to go get a colonoscopy. That will catch polyps before they turn cancerous. And that's one of the reasons that colon cancer is on the decline. And plus, many women have stopped taking these postmenopausal estrogen pills, which were popular for many years, but they realized that was linked to breast cancer. And as women have stopped taking those pills, that caused a downtick in breast cancer rates.
Okay, so it's reduced the rates, and that's all prophylactic. That's to prevent the onset of cancer. What about treatments once someone has cancer?
In some cases, yes. That the classic example is treatment of childhood cancers, and those treatments have made those cancers much less deadly in many cases. There have also been incremental improvements in treatment for many other cancers. Of course, detecting cancer early has played some role in that, because if you can catch it earlier, it's generally more treatable in many instances. And these are not cures a lot of the time, but at least the treatments add years to people's lives. And of course, we should not forget that treatment is what people think about when they're asking that question, have we won the war on cancer, or is there progress in the war on cancer? So in that regard, we're clearly far from victory. Remember back in 1971, when Richard Nixon declared this war, the optimists really hoped that it would be just like putting a man on the moon, you know, a fabulous success we just experienced. But that was clearly far too simple a view of the disease the many diseases that we call cancer.
So I wonder, Richard, in closing, if you can take a step back a little bit. You've covered so many stories about medicine, about science. As you do your research for this particular series, what you come away with, whether there were any surprises for you as you revisit cancer, something you've covered a lot over the years but are now just getting back into. What's your takeaway?
Yeah, well, it is interesting because I had spent a lot of time not covering cancer for the last 10 or 15 years or even longer than that. And so when I came back to the story, I thought, well, what has changed? And there were a few drugs that have come on the scene that have made a huge difference. And I think there was a hope that like Gleevec, which cures a couple of cancers, has a really dramatic effect. And there was a thought, well, you know, this is the new frontier on cancer. We haven't seen that replicated in a lot of other cancers yet, but there seems to be a hope that that could happen. I think the other thing that I came away realizing was that there's still no really organizing intellectual principle that really would say, here is cancer, you know, in its simplest sense, and if we can, you know, if we can really understand these basic things, that would lead to absolute to cures, or at least much stronger treatments. I mean, there's progress on, you know, thousands of different fronts, but nothing that had actually pulled everything together into one place and said, you know, here's the intellectual foundation that we can operate on to make, you know, rapid progress in a lot of areas.
All right. Well, we appreciate your insights and your research. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lisa.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins. Robin Young is back on Monday.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.